Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about federal forest planning in this hour. We just completed a reporter debrief on the BLM forest management plans for Western Oregon. Now let's pull back and get a bit more general on forest management and the idea that maybe trees have as much or more value standing as they do cut and on the way to sawmills. Our next guest considers this proposition. Ernie Niemi is an economist with a long resume. He formed Natural Resource Economics, Inc. in 2012. From 1978 to 2012, he managed economic and policy analysis for the consulting firm Eco Northwest, where he was a co-owner, vice president, and senior economist. He's also taught cost-benefit analysis and economic development for the University of Oregon's Department of Planning, Public Policy, and Management, and taught high school science as a Peace Corps volunteer in Uganda. I told you he had a long resume. Ernie Niemi, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So what does your company do, Natural Resource Economics, Inc.? Can you give us some project examples?
Well, I can. What we try to do is look at the interrelationship between ecosystems and local economies, or even national economies. And so, for example, we look at the importance in terms of forests, just as you said. What are the services that we get from a healthy forest, whether that's clean water or it's habitat for species or it's recreational opportunities? And we try to look at what the trade-offs are then when you cut those trees down in order to generate logs and try to understand to the extent whether the overall economy is better off when you do that or worse off when you do that, as well as who gets the benefits and who ends up with the cost.
Is it hard to make some of these cases? I know when you talk about ecosystem services, and we have used that term in previous conversations on the exchange, it's easy to make the case for something like clean water, like a forest is good with standing trees because you get clean water from it. But when you talk about things like, well, let's say spotted owls, for example, I mean, it seems to be like it's a harder case to make for preserving a critter or a series of critters in the forest. It seems like more of a secondary or tertiary benefit to the human beings who would view these as ecosystem services.
Well, I don't think that's correct. I think you're confusing there. Where in some cases we have markets. And so we have markets that buy and sell logs, and so we have an easy way for us to tell what the value of that log is. For other things, we don't have markets, and so it's not that there's no value, it's just that it's harder for us to figure it out. And so economists have spent an awful lot of time on these issues, as you can imagine, and they still are. And with respect to, say, habitat for spotted owls, one of the ways that you try to look at this is you do very sophisticated survey research and you let people choose. You know, would you rather have logs or would you rather have habitat for owls? And the research that's been done on this indicates that people would very clearly rather have habitat for owls when they think that owls are in jeopardy of going extinct. And so, we do have pretty good estimates of value. And it's just that it takes different techniques to come up with the values of different things.
When we talk about values then, Ernie, are we talking about an actual dollars and cents or something a little more esoteric?
Oh, it is actually dollars and cents. One of the things that gets an awful lot of attention right now is climate change and carbon dioxide going into the air. And so we know, for example, that as carbon dioxide goes into the air, it results in, or is associated with, more floods, more droughts, more storms, more heat waves that kill people and the like. And so economists have gone through this list of effects and tried to estimate what is the damage associated with a single ton of carbon dioxide going up into the atmosphere. And we have some pretty good estimates. They're not complete yet. They are, because we haven't been able to quantify all of the different costs, but we have very good dollar and cents numbers.
Ernie Niemi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an economist with Natural Resource Economics, Inc., his company in Eugene. We're talking about forest management and the ways to look at it in terms of the value of forests, both standing and not. He'll be talking in Grants Pass on tomorrow at 6:30 at Ann Basker Auditorium and at the Williams Grange on Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. And you can join us right now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. You've apparently spent a fair amount of time looking at federal forest land management. What jumps out in your analysis, Ernie?
Well, first of all, if you go back to 1994, when the Northwest Forest Plan was first implemented to protect ecosystem services and the health of ecosystems and spotted owls and the like, economists at that time had a pretty good understanding that it just didn't make sense for us to increase logging on federal lands. That, again, back to your dollars and cents, we understood as best we could at that time. We have a better understanding now, but we understood the costs associated with losing soils when you go out and log, the impacts on water quality, the impacts on fish, and especially salmon, the effects on habitat, the effects on recreation. And we knew at that time that on federal lands, such as BLM lands, these costs that you would incur when you increase logging generally would outweigh the benefits, the value of the log. So we knew at that time. And so economists really haven't spent an awful lot of attention to this issue since the mid-1990s. Well, the BLM has undertaken their new resource management plan and all of that. And one of the things that jumps out is that old understanding from back in the 1990s, at least I haven't been able to find it in the thousands of pages that are there. Maybe it's there, but I haven't been able to find it. So that memory has been lost, apparently, with the BLM. Now, I do absolutely applaud them for putting information in there on carbon. And carbon is important in this area because the trees, and especially the trees on federal lands in western Oregon, have some of the highest carbon per acre of any ecosystem in the world.
Highest carbon or carbon retention ability?
Well, it is the amount of carbon. You know, you have big trees out there with big roots, and they're holding on to an awful lot of carbon. Now, what we know from the science, at least as I understand the science, when you cut those trees down, about three-quarters of that carbon would be released into the atmosphere over the next couple of decades. And so one of the issues here is, do you cut trees down to get logs, to get two-by-fours? But when you do that, you have the cost that you impose on people in Oregon, people in the United States, people around the world, by intensifying changes in climate. And the BLM actually put some nice numbers in there on these costs, these carbon costs. And what that shows is that if you just look at their numbers and you compare, say, alternative D, you know, Jess Burns mentioned there are two alternatives. One is the preferred alternative, which is B as in boy, and the high carbon alternative is called alternative D as in David. And if you look at the increase in timber going from the one to the preferred, and then look at the carbon cost of getting that additional timber, the carbon costs outweigh the value of the timber by about 2 to 1. All right, so that for every $1,000 of logs that would be sold to the timber industry, the costs imposed on households and businesses and communities would be about $2,000.
By the release of carbon, we mean.
By the release of the carbon, that's exactly right. Now, the BLM unfortunately relied on old numbers, so they don't have the most up-to-date numbers. And if you look at the current economic literature, that $2 becomes $12. All right?
All right.
So that for every $1,000 of logs that the BLM would sell to the timber industry, there would be $12,000 of costs imposed on other people. But then the BLM also, and I applaud them for this, says, well, that's sort of our average expectations. But we know that climate change could be a lot worse than just our average expectations. And if you account for that possibility, again, using the BLM's own numbers in there, that number rises to more than 30 to 1. So that for every $1,000 worth of trees, of logs, from the industry as it cuts it down, we would be imposing damage around the world of about $30,000.
So a 1 to 1?
No, 30 to 1.
30 to 1. Okay. So, or sorry, you are, so it's $1,000 worth of logs, $30,000 worth of carbon.
$30,000 worth of carbon costs. That's right.
We're talking to economist Ernie Niemi here on the Jefferson Exchange about figuring out the economics of forests and what they would put out and what we put into them. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So in anywhere, and honestly, I haven't had a chance to look very deeply into the BLM documents at all other than some of the summaries. Are there some suggestions within the alternatives then for Western Oregon that perhaps they would log less so as not to release too much carbon?
Well, that is alternative D, as in David. And but the BLM rejected that. So in effect, what the BLM has done, you know, the BLM director basically has said, well, I think it's important to have this timber. And I understand that in order to get the timber, we're going to impose costs on other people that are even bigger than that. But I don't care. So I don't care that the costs exceed the benefits. I'm still going to recommend or prefer alternative B, as in boy, in order to get more timber. And, you know, there are two issues that come up with that. One is, you know, any economy or any community or any family that continues to incur costs greater than benefits impoverishes itself over time.
In a sense, you're like eating your seed corn by doing it this way.
Yeah, you're eating your seed corn, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You know, you can find, you know, any number of metaphors. The second concern is that there are some real ethical issues here, in that some people will realize the benefits, the timber industry and the people who work in the timber industry. Other people will lose their jobs. They will lose their homes. They will see their grandparents die, perhaps, from a heat wave. You know, and these are real issues in the Rogue River Valley.
Ernie, there's a couple things we need to get into here. One of them, which is, how do you change the mechanisms? I mean, if the forests operate in a way that is, well, the forests do what the forests are going to do. We certainly do a lot of management and push them one way or the other. But there are human mechanisms that are based upon what we do to the forests. And in particular, when you're talking about in Western Oregon, where you've got counties that are saying, hey, look, you know, we have no deputies left for patrol because we have no timber income anymore because we're not cutting enough trees. When the mechanisms work in such a way that it is tied to a greater a number of trees getting cut down, how do you work about changing those mechanisms economically to make it good for the forest, good for the county, or do they end up mutually exclusive, for example?
Well, you know, when I talk to my friends in other parts of the United States, they just end up slapping themselves in the forehead. You know, there are any number, you know, there are hundreds of counties in the United States that don't have a BLM cutting trees. And they're able to have sheriff's deputies, they're able to have schools, they're able to have all of these services. So it isn't that somehow not cutting trees is imposing all of this harm on Oregon's counties. Again, as you said, these are just decisions that people have made, and rather than make the decisions that people in other counties make in order to have these services and sort of fess up and say, okay, you know, let's have police services if we want them, and we're willing to pay for them. Instead, we're sort of playing this game of, you know, can we get Uncle Sugar to come and give us the money so that we don't have to pay our own taxes?
Uncle Sugar, the U.S. in this case.
That's correct.
The other question is about private lands and how they would enter into any mix here, because I know from talking to the forester Roy Keene, also from Eugene, within the last year, his major view of things is that you can't just look at the federal forests by themselves. You really should be looking at the private lands as well and be able to consider total issues like exporting of logs, which is allowed from private lands, not allowed from public lands, for example.
Well, that's true. And you're always in between looking at, you know, the individual molecules and then looking at the overall universe. And so you want to be careful about getting stuck at either end of that. But, for example, you know, since the Northwest Forest Plan was adopted in 1994, timber harvests in Oregon have been fairly constant, about 4 billion board feet.
Is that from all land?
From all lands, mm-hmm. That's right. Now, if you start to look at log exports, however, During most of that period, about one log out of 10 has been exported. Well, about 5 years ago, however, that started to increase. And so if you look at the federal numbers from the Forest Service on their official numbers, by about 2012 or so, we were looking at one log in five being exported from the state of Oregon. Now, informally, within the industry, you look at some of the trade publications from last year, they were talking about one log out of two being exported.
Really?
Now, every time that you export a log, of course, you're not putting that log, you know, set aside everything else about whether the log should be cut or not cut. But once you have the log, and it's on the log truck, and if it goes to the mill, then you're creating jobs within the mill. But if that log truck drives right past the mill and goes to Coos Bay or goes to Astoria, and the log goes onto a ship and goes across to China, then you're not realizing those jobs in the mills. And so, again, there's this tendency to say, well, the solution is only to cut more logs. And no, that's not true. You know, there are other parts to this equation, and we can have different decisions being made all along this entire industrial process or this forest management process in order to achieve our objectives. So if we really wanted to have more jobs from the logs that we already have, why don't we try to find a way to keep those logs and have them processed here rather than just simply exported overseas?
Ernie Niemi, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I'm intrigued by the statement from your website, and it reads as follows. Many ecosystems have value because they reduce the cost of goods and services consumed by households, businesses, and communities. Are we talking about ecosystem services there?
Oh, we certainly are. Anything from, in downtown Medford and Ashland, you have an awful lot of trees. That makes it a lot cooler, right? So you don't have to buy whatever you want in order to stay cool. We know that clean water as it comes down, the Rogue River Valley provides all sorts of amenities, whether they are recreational or whether it's irrigation water or whether it's you just simply like to have the ability to see this river flowing through your communities. There are more important things that go on, or more direct things that go on, perhaps. We know that forests and other ecosystems help regulate the flow of water. So in the area that we're talking about, of Western Oregon, Western Northern California, we know that big trees, during the fog will condense on the needles of big trees and drip down onto the ground. And a lot of that water goes into, the aquifer, the subsoil water, and ends up in our streams in the late summer. So when you cut down the big trees, we know that stream flows, especially in late summer, tend to go dry. Right, and so there are all kinds of services that we obtain from the ecosystem.
That's an excellent one, though, that you started with. I was talking about the leafy trees that give you cover, provide shade, keep you cooler. You're not going to have to buy as much lemonade, and you're not going to have to run your air conditioner quite as much. Ernie, in looking at things like markets and non-market forces, and I understand you look at both in your economic analysis, in order for people to consider standing trees as having value, for example, does a market need to be developed? Does somebody have to get paid for that tree to stay standing?
Oh, maybe. We've certainly gone for a long time without that. You have to think about, why do people live in Jackson and Josephine counties, for example? An awful lot of people live there not because there's a sawmill or because they own a chainsaw. They live there because there's a particular quality of life that they enjoy, and they're able to have a job and earn a living and enjoy life. So we know that, for example, trees play a very large role in this. It's not the only role. They're not the only ones that contribute to quality of life. But we know that people like to go out into trees. They like to see trees on the hillside. They like to see the water. They like to see the animals. They like to know that the animals are there, even if they don't go out and see them. So, sort of imagine if you had a sort of massive overnight shift and you woke up in the morning and all of the federal forests of Jackson and Josephine counties were gone tomorrow morning when you woke up. It would be a very different place, and I expect that for an awful lot of people, it would be a less desirable place to live. So we already see people making decisions. We see force playing a role in the economy without having markets. Now, we can have markets. We can have markets for carbon, for example. California has gone a long way in this direction. And so there is the possibility of earning revenues. Jess Burns was talking about revenues to counties that it has received in the past from cutting trees down. Well, it is entirely plausible that we could have a similar mechanism for the people of the United States, in effect, to pay the people in Jackson and Josephine counties, because the forests of Jackson and Josephine counties reduce the cost from another Hurricane Katrina or another Superstorm Sandy, whatever, associated with climate change, so that these forests are providing a service. People ought to pay for that. We can come up with these mechanisms if we want to. People just have to get past the denial about, A, climate change, or B, that we're going to have to do things differently in order to come up with these mechanisms.
Does it necessarily then start with public money? I mean, does it have to be taxpayer money that starts the process?
Well, the notion that you can have a private market operating exclusively distinct from and separate from the government is a real fallacy. What a market means is that you have some enforcement mechanism, and usually that is a government, with lawyers and courts and whatnot to enforce contracts. That's all that a market is. It's a way to enforce your decisions and agreements. So, yeah, there's a role for the public sector to play. There's a role for the private sector to play. In the California system, the state of California has basically set the market up, and they allow different people to buy and sell carbon, in effect. And what we've seen coming out of that, for example, is that large forest owners in South Carolina have struck a deal and said, look, we were going to cut our timber, but we're not going to do that. We're going to let our trees grow and store more and more carbon to keep it out of the atmosphere. And somebody else comes along and pays them to do that so that they can continue to do what they want to do.
So it becomes a bidding thing. I mean, if I am bid more for my trees standing than I am for my trees on the way to the mill, horizontal, then I'll go with the higher bid.
Sure.
Let us take some calls here. We have Mitch in Mendocino on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking forest economics with the economist Ernie Niemi. Hi, Mitch.
Hi. As you said, I'm in Mendocino. I'm 76. I've been fighting what we've called here the timber wars for a long time. And excuse me, in your last minute or so, you've answered much of what I was about to ask you, which is that the timber industry is pretty intransigent and pretty tough, and they own an awful lot of influence, police and sheriffs and so forth. And so listening to Ernie, I think, well, I certainly do agree with what he says. I find it's fascinating, some of the calculations that he has given us I haven't heard before, and they're pretty impressive. But how in the world are you going to impose this on an industry that's as tough-minded as that? And if it's a federal forest, who's going to, particularly with business running the show more than democratic process these days, how in the world are you going to impose some real controls over these things? Or are you whistling in the dark?
All right. Thanks for the question, Mitch. Appreciate it. Ernie?
Well, it actually raises some really, really interesting issues here. Just as an illustration, first of all, of the industry's power. Before the early 1990s, Washington, Oregon, and California all imposed a tax on timber that had been harvested, a timber harvest tax, and they're about the same. In 1993, though, the industry in Oregon persuaded the legislature to initiate a process to phase out that tax. And so the industry in Oregon no longer pays a tax when it cuts trees down and hauls them off to do whatever they want with them. The same corporations with, in effect, identical trees, does pay a tax in Washington and in California. Now, if Oregon had the Washington system, then the counties on the west side of Oregon, the so-called O&C counties, would be receiving about $40 million a year from a timber harvest tax.
Which is not what they were getting from the feds, but it's not chump change.
It's
either.
Not chump change at all. All right. And so when we talk about, you know, the only option that we have is to cut down trees. Well, no, there is another option. In effect, what the industry did is it reached into every county budget and it grabbed $40 million and took it back to their own incomes. And so we see very clearly that there are some options. They don't rely on Congress. We can do this in the Oregon State Legislature. You know, I'm astounded that we have county commissioners in these O&C counties that continue to argue, well, we need our only thing, you know, woe is me. We don't have sheriff services. We don't have child services, whatnot. We've got to cut down trees or send us money from Uncle Sugar. Why aren't those people in Salem saying, let's have a new timber harvest tax if we want to have that revenue? It works in Washington. It works in California. You know, I don't see these timber industries going bankrupt there because the taxes are too high. You know, and so there are some options. Now, is it easy? No, it's not easy. But you know, this is the world. And so these are just real options.
Let's take another call here from Rex in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ernie Neamey.
Hello, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Hi, yes, I'm also from Mendocino, and I'm going to echo that last intelligent caller, and thank you very much for this program. I would like to kind of amplify his remarks, that this is, in every case, a fight. I mean, you're saying, you're putting it clearly that it is a fight. It's against people that have a avaricious, rapacious greed who will not stop until the last tree is cut. I'm not digressing here, but I'm sitting in the middle of the salmon season down here. We're about to lose the last of our salmon in the Noyo River. And the fishermen are out without compunction or apology or any kind of concern for the loss of this enormous resource. And they'll do that to the trees. They'll do that to the big trees up in the Rogue River. And I would like to suggest, you know, in a general way, that the Democrats and the Republicans are never their own lock, stock, and barrel. And whether or not they're overtly against cutting trees, or whether, you know, whether they pretend like they're against cutting trees, or whether they're outright for it, they're all in the same system of favors and traded favors, and they're out to benefit themselves politically. And the people that are the cutters, the loggers, are sophisticated professional people that work full time at destroying these forests. And if there is going to be a meaningful resistance, you have to abandon those political parties, get into the Green Party, form a party, and you have to vote the people. Right now, we're about to have a recall in Mendocino County, a recall election, first one ever. And it's because people are becoming increasingly aware and increasingly angry. This is not just a sit back and take it kind of a thing. If we don't fight, we're going to lose.
That's recall of whom?
Pardon me?
Recall of whom?
Well, in our case, we're recalling the city council in Fort Bragg.
All right.
But it's small potatoes. But Fort Bragg sits right in the middle of a bunch of forests, and we also have a number of ecological issues. And it was thought that it couldn't be done. It was thought to be an impossibility. We now have 300 or 400 people at a city council meeting where we used to have 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a matter of public. I can tell you how it happened. It happened for, well, I can tell you in one word, listserv. It's because people got on the internet and they started communicating and started talking to each other.
Okay, Rex, before this turns into a complete filibuster, I need to get a question from you.
I'm sorry. Well, my question, it is a filibuster. I'm sorry. But I feel passionately about it. I'm sorry to go, I've gone on perhaps too long. I'll let you go. But what I'm saying is you've got to organize and you've got to fight.
All right.
And we can fight if we do it on the internet. And I'm sorry to have spoken so vehemently. I didn't mean to get carried away there. But I do appreciate your program, and I feel passionately about this. I bet everybody in Oregon does as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a casual sit-on-the-couch issue. This is our life and our death.
All right, Rex, thanks for that. Very much, very good to hear from you. Ernie, thoughts? One of the things you talk about is taking the emotion out.
Well, I mean, that's you know, economists have the reputation for having no emotion. And there's a reason for this, is that we look around and we see that people do have values and they are making choices and they do have preferences for this and versus that. And so in the old days, for example, all of this was portrayed as we had to choose between the environment and the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard this however many times from however many senators and governors and whatnot of, well, we all know that we'd like to have a nice environment, but the reality is that, you know, we just have to have jobs. And so we're going to cut down the trees. Well, what economists have done over the last 20, 30 years is put some numbers on that so that people can better understand what that trade-off really is. And so, for example, if you look at the jobs, we used to have the argument that, well, the only way to have jobs from a forest was to cut it down. Well, I participated in an exercise in the early 1990s where we quantified the timber jobs and the fishing jobs. And what we found out was that the fishing jobs are just about the same number as the timber jobs. And so very quickly, people began to see, and including elected officials here in the state of Oregon, and in particular, Governor Barbara Roberts, began to see very clearly that it was not a choice between jobs versus the environment. It was a choice between jobs versus jobs, and what sort of jobs, what sort of economy would you like to have? Would you like to have a few timber jobs and the, you know, and lose all of the jobs associated with recreation and the like, or with attracting people to our particular communities? Or would you rather have healthier communities, healthier economies across the board, and fewer jobs associated with chainsaws? And so that's what economists do, is try to quantify that.
Well, you've got a big task to talk to people about that coming up. I want to point out again, your appearances are going to be in Grants Pass tomorrow, May 6th at 7 o'clock at the Ann Basker Auditorium in Grants Pass. Doors open at 6:30. The following night, also at 7 o'clock at the Williams Grange, the doors open at 6 o'clock for that. Ernie Niemi is an economist with Natural Resource Economics, Inc., based in Eugene. Ernie, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.